AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. Today, we are taking a trip back, way back to St. Louis, Missouri. The year is 1883. We're looking at a story that sits really uncomfortably at this intersection of, well, grand ambition, fabricated royalty, and frankly, profound local horror. This deep dive is centered entirely on a figure named Harold Crane. Our sources define him as a failed aristocrat, basically a man who couldn't achieve the status he really craved legitimately. So he created his own sort of perverse kingdom, and he populated it with the city's most vulnerable people, children seeking assistance.
It really is a critical historical profile. And our sources, they detail the life and the incredibly disturbing legacy of this figure. They focus especially on the elaborate, almost ritualized control he exerted, all under the guise of benevolence, you know? Our mission here, for you the listener, isn't just to recount the tragedy, though we will. It's to meticulously unpack the precise mechanisms of that control. Specifically, how the language, the vocabulary of honor, charity, and royalty was used, almost like a psychological weapon, to mask systematic abuse.
That distinction is so key, isn't it? The source material paints this vivid picture of a man who didn't just rely on simple force. No, instead, he built an entire theatrical stage for his delusions. We're going to detail how the memory of the specific crimes and the really unusual nature of the food involved how that became fixed permanently in local lore under a moniker that is now tragically, almost satirically familiar.
And what's fascinating from an analytical standpoint, I think, is the profound duality of the era itself. You know, the late 19th century in America, the Gilded Age. It was a time defined by public spectacle, these ostentatious displays of wealth, and, importantly, charity. Charitable banquets back then were often highly theatrical public displays. It showed off social hierarchy, really intended to elevate the benefactor more than anything. Crane merely took this existing framework, this idea of performative charity, and just pushed it to its absolute monstrous extreme.
Okay, so we aren't just looking at a criminal act here. We're really examining a deliberate exploitation of social custom. We'll be focusing on things like charity as theater and ritualized eating as control, analyzing how these kind of elevated terms, royal, faced, honor, became crucial components in basically reframing submission as status for his victims.
Exactly. And if we look beyond the immediate events, the story of Crane gives us this critical insight into history and memory itself. A case where the horrific artifact, you know, the local nickname, the persistent legend, it actually outlives the maker. And crucially, it provides the context for the unspeakable crime itself. It ensures the horror, in a specific localized form, persists long after maybe the physical evidence has decayed.
Right. So let's start the timeline. Let's go to 1883 with the construction of his whole persona. #tagI. The failed aristocrat and the theater of charity. 1883, king persona and aesthetic. Okay, let's unpack this. St. Louis, 1883. Harold Crane. He was a man who, despite his best efforts, was, well, a financial failure. He lacked any inherited nobility, any real status. Yet he possessed this intense craving for grandeur, for absolute authority. His solution, engineer a restoration of his status entirely through performance. He just styled himself as a king.
Yeah, the self-signing, that's the crucial first step, isn't it? He didn't need a formal coronation, you know, none of that. He needed a belief system. And he enforced that belief by demanding immediate, non-negotiable compliance from these kids. He wore no actual crown, the sources are clear on that, but he demanded every child who entered his dining hall kneel before him. Crane understood fundamentally that authority could be manufactured through insistent, repeated performance, and, importantly, through the creation of a physical space that reinforced that narrative.
That space, the banquet hall, the sources describe it with chilling detail. It was designed specifically to reinforce his fiction of royalty, but it was, well, it was far from genuine. We're talking about a grotesque throne room, really, a makeshift court built on borrowed status.
Mm-hmm. The sources emphasize the specific aesthetic choices, too, and they really reveal the sham at the core of his operations. The hall featured these extraordinarily long tables, right? And red cloth meant to suggest velvet, luxury, but it was noticeably sagging from the beams, just hanging there. There were chandeliers, yes, but they were stolen, and the wax apparently dripped heavily, suggesting neglect, decay, just underneath the veneer. It was a crumbling facade, really, built on status he couldn't actually afford or earn.
How crucial was this whole aesthetic, this kind of borrowed status, to deceiving the public? Because that deceit, it seems, was total. Crane was apparently broadly admired in the city. Neighbors genuinely believed he was running this maybe eccentric, but generous charity, helping feed the poor. Children across the city would apparently whisper about him with a sense of hope, dreaming of maybe getting an invitation.
And that public perception, well, that was the perfect camouflage for his private operations, wasn't it? It mirrors how systems of control often operate, perform some virtuous activity publicly, and it grants you a license for unchecked private behavior. Mm-hmm. The community saw a benefactor, so they just ignored the strange details of the operation, the oddities. This allowed him to establish what was essentially an independent internal regime, a little kingdom where he was the absolute sovereign.
And the very architecture, the whole king persona, it wasn't just decorative, was it? It was functional. It was designed to enforce immediate obedience right upon entry. The entire setup reframed the act of receiving a handout not as charity, but as, like, a step up the social ladder, making the most vulnerable feel privileged simply to be allowed inside his doors.
Yes. And this speaks directly to that concept we sometimes discuss. You know, the game trains you before it pays you.
Yeah.
By making entry and participation totally contingent on acknowledging his fabricated authority, kneeling to a man with no real crown, Crane was pre-training his victims, training them to accept a new, intensely subordinate reality. They accepted the terms of his game before they ever received the promised reward, the meal, establishing the psychological foundation of debt and loyalty from the outset. Hashtag two, invitations, paper crowns, and the throne room.
Right. And the path into this engineered reality, it started with the invitation itself. We really need to understand that receiving a written summons to the hall, it was perceived by these children not as simply fulfilling a need, like getting food. No, it was seen as achieving a great honor, a manufactured feeling of belonging, of exclusivity that Crane intentionally cultivated. It was like currency.
Exactly. The invitation transformed basic necessity into perceived privilege. And then, once inside the throne room, the psychological props immediately took over. The children were given paper crowns. Now, this is such a critical symbol, isn't it? Cheap, flimsy material instantly transformed into a symbol of elevated status. And the instruction, of course, was to bow low before him while receiving it.
Can you just imagine the tension in that moment? The flimsy nature of that paper crown? It's a symbol of profound poverty, really set against the intense weight of the occasion, the forced reverence, that mix of dread and excitement. The sheer cheapness of the material only emphasizes the absolute fragility, the falsehood of the honor being bestowed.
Absolutely. And the manipulation lies in that substitution, the ritualized bowing, the paper crowns. They establish this fundamental dynamic where submission was actively mistaken for privilege. The psychological maneuver was basically, I give you this status, this flimsy paper crown, and in return, you owe me total deference, the bow. It's a transaction disguised as a gift.
And then, okay, then there was the meal itself, meticulously named, of course, to continue the whole theatrical motif. Crane dubbed the food the Royal Burgers. Our sources describe these as just patties of ground meat pressed between bread, but piled unnervingly high on cold tin plates.
That combination of details is just horrifyingly specific. The naming royal adds to the vocabulary of false privilege, obviously. But the method of serving, it just strips the food of any dignity, any warmth. The cold tin plate emphasizes the lack of care, the sort of industrial nature of the transaction, and the inherent lack of warmth. It wasn't a nourishing meal. It was a standardized ration delivered under this false banner of luxury.
So we have the ritualized bowing, the cheap crowns, the cold tin plates, the sustained use of the word honor here. It's just a prime example of how language can work to sanitize, to launder harm, right? By accepting the crown, they basically accepted the premise of the entire system.
Absolutely. The act of kneeling, receiving the crown, it wasn't just a mere formality. It was a psychological operation. Designed to measure devotion, to extract absolute submission before the essential reward, the food, was even provided. The children were psychologically bound to the king's rules before they took a single bite.
It's the ultimate form of coercion, really. It ensures the children feel deeply indebted, immensely privileged just to be there. It creates this setup where the true cruelties that followed could be interpreted, maybe by both the king and potentially even the victims themselves, as a consequence of their failure, not the perpetrator's malice. Like, they failed the rules of his court.
Exactly. By accepting the paper crown, they implicitly bought into the whole theater. The consumption that followed, however painful, was simply the next necessary role they had to play in Crane's self-constructed royal court, hashtag tag three, the royal seat of control, forced eating and performance.
Okay, so here is where Crane's true motivation as the banquet hall king, it becomes undeniably clear. His goal wasn't sustenance. It certainly wasn't charity. It was twisted entertainment, derived purely from the children's struggle, their distress. He demanded they eat and keep eating relentlessly, long past the point of society, until they physically just could not continue.
Yeah, this ritualized, forced eating. It completely subverts the whole notion of a meal, doesn't it? It stopped being nourishment and became this potent tool of control. The cruelty was defined by the specific physical details the sources relay. Children were compelled to finish every single scrap of these royal burgers, even as they openly wept or choked on the dry meat or suffered from acute sickness. The food itself was functionally a weapon, used to enforce absolute immediate obedience.
And the required performance of gratitude, that was perhaps the most disturbing element. Crane didn't just passively observe this horror. He actively commanded and participated. He would cheer, apparently, and clap when the children choked or retched. He forced the entire scene into this sick, cruel parody of a celebratory banquet. Their physical misery was the only required performance that truly satisfied him. Crane would command the applause when the children coughed, turning suffering into spectacle.
But the true sound in that moment was the painful sound of weeping and choking. The raw reality of physical distress fighting against the forced theater of reverence and gratitude. And, to ground this critique a bit, we really must acknowledge the broader context of the period. Victorian charitable banquets, they were often highly organized, strictly regulated events. They were intended primarily to showcase the virtue of the provider and to ensure the poor understood their subordinate place. The benefactor's control over the whole process, the timing, the amount, the required demeanor, that was already a defining feature of charity back then.
Wow. So Crane didn't invent the mechanism of charity as display. He just violently maximized it, pushed it to its absolute limit. The implication of this forced consumption is just chilling. Total, absolute obedience was the true price demanded in exchange for the false honor of the invitation. The physical act of eating became the measure of their subservience to his crown.
Exactly. Furthermore, the length and the sheer intensity of the meal were designed to break them down. It demonstrated to everyone present, including the children themselves, that their physical comfort, their health, it mattered far less than their compliance with the king's rules. That royal burger on the cold tin plate, it was transformed into this horrifying, exhausting test, a test of devotion and psychological endurance.
The sources really suggest that the theatrical element, the king's applause, his demands, it was all intended to mask the internal horror of the victims. Almost to normalize it within that space. He needed them to perform hunger first, then perform gratitude, and finally perform absolute submission until they physically broke down. All so he could maintain his illusion of power, even right there in the face of their obvious suffering.
It really solidifies the system of governance within the hall. Outside, sure, he was Harold Crane, maybe a benevolent eccentric to some, but inside, he was the king, and the rules were non-negotiable. Enforced not just by his presence, but by the relentless, suffocating pressure of the meal itself. Hashtag tag four, the winter silence and the evidence of erasure.
So as the months wore on and the harsh St. Louis winter arrived, the internal horrors of that hall began to, well, bleed into the community's awareness. Through a chilling emergent pattern, children began to vanish. Neighbors started noticing the abrupt and total silence coming from the hall, where before there had been these late-night feasts, the occasional sounds of voices. Now, nothing.
That transition from the spectacle of the feast, all the noise, the forced applause, to the sudden chilling quiet of winter. It's a powerful narrative image in the sources. Our source material notes that locals initially spoke of midnight feasts, tales of excitement, maybe royal treatment. But those stories were soon cut short, replaced by this uncomfortable silence, this suspicion hanging heavy in the air.
No, we have to be careful here, right? We're relying on persistent local rumor and legend to reconstruct the full scope of the tragedy. These gruesome claims, they've persisted in St. Louis lore for decades. The story goes that when Crane finally died, the full horror became undeniably apparent. Reports say that authorities discovered the cellar contained barrels. Barrels filled with salted flesh and bones. It's a detail that provides the specific macabre focal point for the subsequent legend that grew up around him.
Right. And regardless of the precise historical documentation of those specific contents, which is hard to verify definitively, what is crucially, chillingly factual, according to the sources, is the record keeping of the crime. The sources state explicitly that the lids of these discovered barrels were marked only with dates, just dates. No names, no personal records, no reference whatsoever to the individual lives erased, just the date of inventory.
That is what truly transforms the crime from simple madness into something systematic, a systematic horror. This cold, organized inventory provided the only record of the victims. Crane, the theatrical showman, applied this meticulous administrative system to unspeakable acts. It suggests a man organizing his crimes with the precision, the detachment of a supply manager just logging inventory.
Exactly. And this specific detail, the dated lids, that's the key analytical nugget here. It cuts right through all the theatrics. It suggests that while the individual lives were intentionally erased, the perpetrator maintained this chronological, systematic log of his operations. He needed to keep track of his inventory, regardless of the humanity involved.
Wow. It echoes that haunting concept we sometimes explore in other deep dives, you know, that records can freeze while lives keep moving. In this case, the structured numerical evidence, just the date marks, became the horrifying silent witness to the crime, turning the cellar into a literal bureaucracy of erasure.
And this cold administrative system, it starkly contrasts with the life Crane projected, doesn't it?
Right.
He spent his life performing royalty, seeking status, demanding emotional deference from children. Yet at the moment of the ultimate crime, he stripped away all that theatricality, replaced it with chilling logistics. The date marks became the only epitaphs, denying the children even the basic dignity of a name in his ledger. It's just cold. #V, the lingering name and the unintended legacy.
So following the discovery, the shocking revelation of the cellar, the community was left grappling with this impossible truth. The royal burgers, they weren't a blessing. They were a tool of forced compliance and ultimately doom. The sheer cruelty, the forced eating, the scale of the vanishings. It demanded some kind of public reckoning, some means to encapsulate the horror.
Mm-hmm. And the specific horror was so intrinsically linked to his performance, wasn't it? His identity as the king, the name of the meal itself.
Yeah.
That town lore needed a sharp, immediate moniker to hold all those details together. Our sources state that town lore quickly dubbed Harold Crane the Burger King.
Right, and we absolutely must emphasize this for you, the listener. We need to frame this accurately. This is a tragic, purely accidental local nickname from 1880s St. Louis. It captured the horrifying nature of his specific royal burgers and his exaggerated king persona. It bears absolutely no relation, none whatsoever, to any modern entity or corporation. It's crucial to understand that separation.
Absolutely crucial. But the power of that specific coincidental nickname, it cannot be overstated and have the story persisted locally. It stuck with this terrifying tenacity. It ensured the story, the crime were never truly buried. The name itself, the Burger King, became the vessel, the container for the entire narrative of horror. A strange two-word encapsulation of the paper crowns, the cold tin plates, the systemic forced consumption that defined his reign of terror.
It's like an accidental preservation tactic, isn't it? Think about that reflection for a moment. A dark local tale, complete with its own specific disturbing imagery. The forced bowing, the flimsy paper crown, the freezing tin plate, the choking children, all of it becomes entirely encapsulated in just two simple, horribly resonant words. The sheer chance similarity with a term that would later gain widespread recognition ensured the memory, at least locally, would resonate far beyond the lifespan of the initial tragedy. It kept the story alive in a way nothing else might have.
And the ultimate irony, really, of Harold Crane's life is that his intended weapon, the system of control, the literal systemic erasure of the children through those administrative logs, the dated lids, it resulted in a lingering moniker that guaranteed the story would persist. The man himself was buried and largely forgotten, but the name was never buried with him.
The tale, almost like a dangerous sealed treasure or maybe a cursed object, became this narrative trap that preserved the memory of the crime. The name provides the continuing context for the erasure, ensuring that the horrific details of the banquet hall king's reign of terror could never fully be dismissed as just rumor or forgotten history. #outro. Wow, what a deep dive that was. Into the historical exploitation of ritual, of authority, of basic human need. We have meticulously explored how a failed aristocrat, Harold Crane, manufactured a throne room out of, well, stolen goods in St. Louis, 1883. And how he expertly deployed the coercive vocabulary of charity and honor to orchestrate this chilling system of theatrical, absolute control.
And the critical takeaway for you, the learner, I think, is to observe the precise process, how these rituals, the kneeling, the paper crowns, the forced consumption, are used systematically to train people into systems of obedience. This mechanism ensures that the victim is often made psychologically complicit in the very theater of their own harm, accepting the terms of the game because, well, the alternative is starvation or exclusion.
Yeah, and the focus on the artifacts, the physical objects, is so crucial to our understanding here. The contrast between the elaborate illusion, the royal feast, and the horrifying reality, the sickness, the choking, the cold dated lids, it just shows us that power derived from control is often built on the cheapest, flimsiest materials imaginable, like paper crowns and stolen, dripping chandeliers.
Mm-hmm. And this dive really showed us that fragile, complex line between documentation and enduring legend, didn't it? You have the cold administrative record of the dated lids found in the cellar versus the enduring, vivid myth preserved by that specific, chilling local nickname. The story of the banquet hall king serves as this dark, profound reminder that sometimes the myth, the legend, steps in to provide the only necessary context for the act of systematic erasure. It fills the void left by the destruction.
The tin plate, cold and heavy, marked with the residue of a false royal feast.